All right. Happy to welcome back to the program the president of Murata Wealth Management. The topic today is behavioral economics, how and why economic decisions are made. David Murata with us. Thank you so much for joining us on The Shilling Show.
Thank you.
And we could also tell people they can visit you online at emarotta, that's M-A-R-O-T-T-A.com, emarotta.com. Now, there's this whole field of behavioral economics, and it's fascinating to me because as I was reading through the columns for preparation of today's show, the columns that you wrote and people can access on your website, emarotta.com, talking about the subject, I saw myself in many of these behavioral economic descriptions that you had put forward. And I'm sure that I'm not alone. This is probably something that is easily generalizable as you could look through and see people's behavior. So let's first talk about the field of behavioral economics broadly before we get into the specifics. Where did it come from and who kind of thought about looking at how people behave when they're dealing with economics?
Yeah, people have found that our first reaction to any complicated situation is usually instinctive, and it serves us in a thousand different ways. When you're in a crowd and you're trying to find your way, there's a lot of clues you take from the people in front of you, and so following the people in front of you is the reason why hundreds of people in a room are not bumping into each other. And that's called the herd mentality, and it's instinctual, it's built into us, it's very helpful. Unless you get into a complicated situation in which the herd mentality does not serve you well. If you're a bison, it helps you find water. They found only 5% of bison need to know where water is for the entire herd to find water. But if you're an investor, then by the time you get to the green pastures, they've been trampled and you find yourself buying into stocks too late. They've already gone up and now they're ready to go down. So sometimes our instincts are helpful and sometimes they're not. And behavioral finance is looking at how our instincts either serve us well or don't serve us well. And most of behavioral finance is trying to identify those instincts that don't serve us well in order to avoid them through a more careful analysis.
But it's very difficult, though, to fight the herd mentality. And it's something that people need to be aware of, first of all, which is why I'm really glad you wrote the series of articles and why we have an opportunity to talk about it today. You have to be aware of it, but you also have to be able to fight those instincts. And they are instincts, aren't they?
Yeah, and they're instincts which the majority will follow. And so being a contrarian often means figuring out exactly what you would do instinctively and then doing the opposite because you know intellectually it serves you well going forward. And so you're right, it's much more analytical and it's trying to take the emotions out of investing. And the emotions are often greed, fear, pride. They're the kinds of things that don't serve us well in the stock market and they don't actually help us reach our long-term goals.
This is an interesting concept, though, because for people who manage their own money, I would imagine that it is very difficult to get the emotion out of it. And yet, somebody like you, and there are many people in business who do the sort of thing that you do, who manage other people's money, are you subject to the same sort of behavioral economic notions that other people are? Or the fact that you're working with somebody else's money, are you able to divorce yourself completely from this notion?
It's a little bit of both. They say that analysts represent about 7% of the population. And analysts are the ones for whom all of the emotional sales techniques and all of the emotions usually don't affect them very much. So when you learn sales techniques, you learn to sell to 93% of the world. And the analysts are the ones for which the sales techniques don't work. But although analysts represent about 7% of the financial world or of the population in general, they represent about 45% of the financial world. So they're largely overrepresented, and a lot of people gravitate toward financial services and financial analysis specifically because it's an area in which their dispassionate analysis actually serves them well. So you don't often find them in things for which passion and emotion play big factors, the theater, the arts, but you find them a lot in finance. And so there's a little bit of a combination, and that is having a financial advisor who's an analyst helps give you a dispassionate perspective on the markets, and then they do things because they know over a student of history this will work well, not because it feels particularly good at the time. And financial analysts have the same emotions when they have them. They just are able to overcome them, and it's not the way they think about the world in general. So during this recent market downturn, even in the midst of the downturn, it looks like a downturn that's more serious, but you're thinking to yourself, okay, at what point is rebalancing back into this and selling your safe investments and buying into these push-down prices going to have the greatest advantage? So when the Dow's dropping to 7,500, you're thinking, okay, is it more likely to be going to 6,500 or 8,500 at this point? Should I be putting some money back in? Should I be putting all the money back in? How much should I be rebalancing? And it is scary when you're doing it, but you know that historically it's the right thing to do. And so often what an analyst does, because we don't have perfect crystal balls, we never know what the market's going to do. Even the market at 6,500, there were people saying it's going to drop to 4,500 on the Dow, and it's going to go even lower. And so quite often what we will do is we will make half a mistake, and we'll take half what we ought to rebalance and put it back into the markets, knowing that if it does drop from 6,500 to 4,500, we still have the other half to put back in to get the benefit of rebalancing back into a drop position. So it is still emotional, but there's a certain personality type which gravitates toward being a financial advisor that sort of helps overcome that and is much more analytical in nature.
It's interesting that you say that. As I think of most of the high profile financial advisors, the ones that are in the media and so forth, most of them are very calm. There's one guy by the name of Jim Cramer who really gets excited. Now, is that just an act, or do you think that carries over into his investment strategies?
I think Jim Cramer has learned the value of putting on a wild analysis just for entertainment value. And he is for investment advice, he has very little value, but for entertainment value, he is just a hoot to watch, because he's always throwing stuff and he's always got his sound effects and everything else. But it's all very short-term timing, and I think he knows better than that. I've talked to a number of financial news people, and they all say that to be in the news, you have to be reporting what happened yesterday. But to be a good financial advisor, you have to be looking forward 2 or 3 years in advance. And it's sometimes, even when I'm writing the column, it's very difficult, because most columns are what you should be buying today. And it's this stock or that stock, and it's trying to pick things that are good for the next 6 weeks so that you have something new to talk about 6 weeks later. The column that I write is a little bit unique in that you get the same advice every single week from a different perspective. I mean, sometimes people say, yes, I know what your column says. It says, be frugal, save, invest, don't rebalance your portfolio, and don't try to market time. And that's a summary of the entire scope of everything that's in my column, and I'm looking at different aspects of how to apply that sage wisdom in different areas of financial planning.
Well, I think people that read it will know there's a consistency there, and I think that speaks very well of you and your advice, that it is consistent. But when we talk about historic markets and then projecting out, it seems to me, David Murata, that we are in a time unlike any other before us, where the world is far less stable, far more prone to the whims of international dictators. Of course, today we had nuclear threats from North Korea. We've got issues in Iran. Israel is constantly under threat. It seems that the oil markets are jittery. And of course, we saw wild fluctuations last year, and I'm sure they're coming up again soon. So how do we say that we're projecting for something in 3 years when we live in such an unstable world?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that I think is interesting is how many times I've heard this time it's different. And if you go back and you're a student of history, that mantra seems to come up again and again and again. World War II, World War I, the dropping of the bomb, the Soviet Union arms race. There's always a really good reason to get out of the markets entirely, buy gold, buy canned food for a year, and wall yourself off from the rest of the world. The world is a very scary place. And volatility does move up and down. It has certain cycles. From 2003 to 2000 and mid-2007, volatility was about half what it normally is historically. And I think that recency, which is one of the economic behavioral finance fallacies you can fall into, that recency has lulled us into thinking that the markets are well behaved. Since mid-2007, the markets have been more than twice as volatile as they normally are. And, you know, just in the last 6 months, more closer to four times as volatile as they normally are, meaning that the daily movements can be 5-10% this past fall. Now they're almost always over 1%. Traditionally, they're under 1%. And so that volatility now makes it feel like times are more uncertain now. But if you look historically over a long period of time, it really isn't. And so this time, it's not different. One of the things I keep hearing is that, you know, because of this recent market downturn, buy and hold is dead. Well, if buy and hold is dead, then how come everyone I know who got out of the markets got out below where they are now? So they got out too soon, and if they had just held on, they would have done better. The Column Monday quotes another study they did, and they found that millionaires who, when the market went down, sold stable investments and bought into equities have $1 million more than the millionaires who, when the market went down, flew to safety and sold equities and bought into bonds. In other words, for large values, it makes $1 million difference whether you're contrarian or you move with the herd.
We're talking with David Morata. You read him weekly in the business section of the Daily Progress on Mondays, and you can visit him online at emorata.com. We'll be happy to take your questions and calls at 977-1070 right after the news break when The Shilling Show returns. It's 12:34 here on The Shilling Show. Thanks so much for joining us. Weekdays from noon to 2, brought to you by fine sponsors like the Jefferson Coin Shop and Diet Pepsi. Thank you so much for supporting our sponsors here on The Shilling Show. They keep us on the air, and so do you. We have a fine and loyal audience that is so supportive of this program. I cannot thank you enough for listening to us in the midst of great competition that we have at this hour. But you're here with us, and we appreciate it very much. 977-1070 is the phone number. And just before we get back to David Morata, I did want to remind you that I asked this question at the top of the hour.
Where is Cynthia Neff?
Because Cynthia refused to come on the program. Well, Cynthia apparently listens, or somebody listens and called Cynthia, and Cynthia Neff will be here by phone, if only for a couple of seconds, at the top of the next hour. She's called and indicated she wants to come on and represent herself as to why she couldn't find any time to appear here on the program. We will certainly welcome her call. So don't tune out. The show will remain a very fascinating place for the next hour and a half. All right, so David Morata is our guest. 977-1070 is the phone number. If you have comments or questions, you can visit David Morata online at emorata.com. And today we are talking about behavioral economics. It's a fascinating topic. Let's get to the this whole issue of anchoring, because it paints a wonderful picture of how people behave.
Yeah, investors tend to fixate on relative past performance. We do this in almost everything we do. If we don't have the expertise to understand what's going on, we pick a number that seems reasonable, and then we try to see is that high or low and adjust from there. And it serves us well in a lot of negotiations. In advertising, people will do a 30% markdown by first doing a 30% markup in the store that's hidden, and then they'll do a 30% markdown from there, and they charge the exact same thing. And most shoppers have gotten savvy about that, but that worked for decades because we anchor. We anchor on the sale price. Wow, I got a $100 coat for only $70. The fact that it might have been $50 the week before is irrelevant to us, because we anchor on what the list price is, and then we move down from there, and we think we've gotten a deal. The same thing is true in finance. If our portfolio goes from $100,000 to $120,000 over the past year, we're happy, because we look at the $100,000 and we look at the $120,000 and we say, woohoo, we made a lot of money. But if it goes from $100,000 all the way up to $150,000 and then it drops back to $120,000 before the end of the year, we're sad and depressed, because we anchor on the high water mark of $150,000. And we don't realize that if you just go back a little further, we actually have a nice 20% return on our money, and that seems to be irrelevant to us.
I think we see the same thing with people's home values. You know, many people obviously are upside down, but there are many people who bought their home and they're lamenting, oh, 2 years ago it was worth $500,000, now it's worth $350,000, but they only paid $125,000 for it. They're in good shape, aren't they?
That's exactly right. And the problem with anchoring is that we make stupid mistakes because of it. If you just looked at your portfolio and it was at 120 and you didn't know where it came from, that's the decisions that you need to be making, is what should you do going forward? And the same thing's true of your home prices, and the same thing's true of all of your finances. Anchoring is a little like finding ourselves sitting in a chair in a pitch black room. We get up from the chair, but we keep one hand on the chair as we're feeling around the room trying to figure out where the door is. The answer, of course, is to turn on the lights, and the minute you have knowledge of the room, then you know what to do. So the problem is that anchoring is a technique we use when we don't have all the information that we need to have, and just being an expert in the subject and knowing what you should do going forward is the answer.
All right, 977-1070 is the phone number. We have a line open for you right now. We also have a caller on line number one. Let's say hello to Gary, and thanks for calling The Shilling Show, Gary.
You're welcome, Rob, and good afternoon, David. I have two questions for you, David. One is, what is your opinion about the so-called or labeled stress test by the Treasury on large and regional banks? And my second question, if you can remember this, is what's happening to GM bondholders?
Yeah, I happen to be a GM bondholder, and I wrote an article about it. And GM bondholders, the first piece that happened is they were being pressured to take, I don't know, it was minuscule, pennies on the dollar, and we could have gotten a better deal in terms of just going to bankruptcy court. It did go to bankruptcy court, and it looks like that GM bondholders will get more. Is it a fair assessment? I don't really know. It's certainly better than the initial proposal. But the government is still going to sort of be involved and be dictating the terms. The unions are still getting a huge lion's share. And I took a little bit of flack in the column because I called that fascism. Fascism is the unification of government and business. So it's sort of socialism with a capitalistic facade. That's the best definition I can see for what fascism is. And unfortunately today, most people think that that's a good idea. And as everyone calls for higher and higher regulations, what they're really calling for is for government to be involved in those kinds of decisions. My worry is that all of the car industry, GM was actually profitable overseas and not profitable domestically. But if you think that going forward, they're going to continue to move more and more of their manufacturing overseas and sell more cars overseas and put more jobs overseas, that's just not going to fly politically with the government having a say in it and the unions owning the lion's share of GM. And so what might make a good business decision doesn't always make good politics. The two don't mix very well. And so my worry is that GM bondholders who will now own a piece of the company will get swamped out by the unions and the government control. And so what's good for the company going forward may not be that good. So my guess is as soon as the GM bonds get converted into GM stock and they can be sold, is probably a good time at that point to go ahead and find a high point in the stock bouncing around and sell out. And then your second question was the stress test in terms of the financials. All the banks were given the ability to take this this bailout money, and they wanted there to be no stigma to taking it. So they gave it to a lot of banks that didn't need it. Then legislation started to come down the pike, which again is a sort of fascism, to say, well, any bank that took took bailout money can't give their normal bonuses. Well, within the financial world, sometimes your salary is a dollar and all you make is bonuses. And so it's very difficult to actually run a company that way without the incentives in the financial world, which is mostly bonus and very little salary. So again, now that all the banks are scrambling because no one's going to make any money to give the money back that they took because they didn't need it, and now they have this stress test to say who can give it back and who can't, which again will stigmatize the banks for which they say you can't give it back. It seems to me too ridiculous for a bank to have taken the money when they didn't need it, and now they can't give it back because the government isn't satisfied, and now they can't give their executives any bonus money, which means they can't even pay them. So it's sort of this odd government trying to run businesses by legislation that just doesn't work.
Okay, thanks, David.
Thank you very much for the call, Gary. That leaves the line open for you at 977-1070. But I think it shows a number of things. And we have so many people today from a micro level to a macro level, David Murata, who are putting their trust and faith into government. And I think that this is showing you that whether it's health care and we put our trust and faith into government providing our health care for us, or whether it's a business like a bank saying, well, we'll just take a little money from the government, or whether it's the state of Virginia saying we're going to take $125 million from the Obama administration to, quote unquote, extend unemployment benefits. There are oftentimes, if not always, strings attached that may be to your demise.
Yeah, the pendulum swings back and forth. The amazing thing to me today is that I say that something is socialism with a capitalistic facade, and I'm getting the reaction, well, what's wrong with socialism? It's amazing how many people don't see the unintended consequences. I ask them if they've read Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, and they say, who's Hayek and what's The Road to Serfdom?
You mean Selma Hayek?
That's exactly right. So we do lack a basic understanding of free markets. And that's the other thing that people say, well, today it's different. None of the free markets worked. We didn't have enough regulation. But everything you can point to are the most regulated industries we have. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had advantages because they were pseudo-government agencies. The financial markets are hugely regulated. And when they're not regulated, it really doesn't matter. The regulation causes them to do things that are bad. The non-regulation causes them to do things that are dangerous. But when you centralize it all together under one set of rules, it makes the house of cards much less stable. And one piece being brought down brings down the whole house.
And I think our house is coming down right before our very eyes. It's frightening. And it's why I make a big deal when I see indoctrination going on in government school classrooms. And it's not limited to one particular teacher or one particular classroom. It's across the board. It comes out occasionally, and we're getting emails from people telling us about where they've seen it. But this is where it starts, or this is where it ends. When you've got kids who don't understand the foundations of the country, they don't understand why it is important to study about how this country was founded and what people fought against and why we were never, never, ever supposed to be a direct democracy, as I now hear people like Tom Perriello talking about. It is 12:44 on The Shilling Show. The phone lines are on fire. Leon's grabbing them right now, so hang on. We will get to you with David Marotta right after this. Stand by. 12:47 here on The Shilling Show, into the final segment with David Marotta. Don't forget Cynthia Neff coming up at the top of the next hour. That's going to be an interesting conversation. Also, Ken Boyd will be joining us for hour number two, so don't go anywhere. Stay glued in your seat or get that transistor radio and bring it with you. We've got one line open and other lines full right now, so don't wait until the end of the hour if you have a question or comment for David Marotta. He's online at emarotta.com, president of Marotta Wealth Management. Let's go right now to Chris. Excuse me, let's see here. Kevin is on line number one. Chris, we'll get to you in just a minute. Hey, Kevin, thanks for calling.
Hi there. I'm on a cell phone, so I hope you can hear it okay.
We can hear you fine. Go right ahead.
Okay. Listening to David, I was enjoying his conversation about, portfolio management and contrarian. I got a little concerned when he talked about banks' compensation for senior executives who took TARP money. I guess, I don't know, it didn't seem it was accurately describing when he said $1 compensation with the rest being in bonuses. That seems a little tantalizing to put that out there. I just wonder if that is true. Can you give specific examples?
Yeah,
from banks that like Chase Manhattan or BB&T.
Sure, actually,
where you can like name that type of compensation.
Yeah, actually, the research I looked at, which I thought was interesting, was AIG traders who make bonus money. It's very, very small. Their actual salaries.
Now, AIG is a problem bank now.
Compared
to BB&T.
I understand that. A lot of bank executives also get. I don't know the actual figures on that. So my $1 was hyperbole. But
I get concerned when I hear that put out there. I mean,
generally within the financial services world, about 40 to 50% of your salary might be bonus money.
Well, I'm okay with that. I understand that. And
right. So if you
I guess my final question would be, does your guest disagree with the government's intent on curbing excessive bonuses, or does he think it was totally?
Yeah, I actually think that bonus money is appropriate in a lot of different fields and for a lot of different executives. I mean, anytime a company does badly, the bonus money is suspect, and you think, why would you ever pay bonuses to people when their company is doing badly? But if another way to think about it is, if you had just had the right kind of executive, your company wouldn't be doing badly. So how do you attract that? How do you attract that level of talent? And one way you attract that level of talent to say, if the company does really well, then you can have your bonus money. Now, I've never quite understood how you can have bonus money when a company is doing badly, because bonus money should be tied to how the company's doing. And when it is tied to how the company's doing, and when the company does well, you do well, and when the company does poorly, you do poorly, then there is great incentive to try to make sure that you're going to do the right things to make the company do well. But I do know that bonus money in the financial services world is a much higher percentage than it is in other areas. And all you have to do is imagine, well, here's a bank that's doing well. They take bailout money because the government doesn't want to stigmatize banks who don't take it, so they give it to everyone. And then now they can't pay it back, and now they can't pay their bonuses. So now, because they took bonus money they don't need, they might have to take a 40 or 50% pay cut. That doesn't really seem fair. That seems like unnecessary meddling. And I think the same thing was true in terms of AIG executives or traders, some of them for whom their contracts said they deserved to be paid a certain amount. They did their jobs well. They weren't in the failed industry and the failed side. AIG is a huge company, and somehow now they get very little money from the fact that they did their jobs well.
And thank you so much for the call, Kevin. I think we lost you on the cell phone there. But, you know, I think ultimately the government has no business in this, and the board of directors of the companies, there are no inappropriate bonuses for the most part, that the board of director of the companies, who is elected by the stockholders, makes these decisions. And if the stockholders don't like it, they can sell their stock. They could elect new members of the board. That's how it should be handled. Certainly not from the government. I don't want anybody in the government saying someone is making too much money. In the same way, I really don't like people from the government setting things like living wage. I think it's bad for the country ultimately. Let's go to line number two, and there is one line open. Don't wait. You got a couple minutes to get in with David Morata, 977-1070. Chris, thanks for waiting. You're on The Shilling Show.
Hello, Rob and Dave. How y'all doing today?
Hey, it's good to hear from you, Chris.
Nice to hear your voice as well. Thanks again for your show. It's very good to hear today on the topics y'all are talking about. I was wondering if you two remember some news reports about 6 or 7 years ago about teenagers in high school, a large number of them cheating on their exams. I don't know if y'all remember any of that coming out over the news.
I remember this at the college level. I'm not sure I remember the high school story.
Well, I heard it over the that it was kind of a trend, apparently. And, you know, I think that when we don't understand, if we as a country don't understand integrity and honor, and we think that if we sacrifice those things for our monetary security, that everything's going to be okay. And I think we're seeing now that that's really not the case, that there are some very high prices to pay when we sacrifice our integrity and our honor as individual people. And also, I wanted to bring up that it seems to me that we're very close to handing over our freedom. It's almost as if no one needs to attack us. It seems like everybody, a lot of intellectuals that I talk with, a lot of UVA students I talk with, they don't seem to think this is such a bad idea, just handing over our freedom like this, you know, in business and in other aspects of our lives. And I find it, I wonder if it's because they don't go to church.
I think that's tied in. Let's let David respond.
Yeah, Chris, you're actually the two things that you've brought up, you brought up perfectly because they're linked. And that is that as more and more of society doesn't have integrity, doesn't have honor, isn't doing the best thing for other people, then everyone cries for, well, what we really need is more laws, because everything that they're doing that's wrong may not necessarily be against the law, but it's wrong nonetheless. And so now we have to have more and more and more laws that specify exactly what you can and can't do. And it's almost a vicious cycle, because then people say, well, we have all of these laws, but look, I may not be doing something you like, and it may not be honorable, and it may not have integrity, but it's not against the law. And so then we have another law that tries to specify that.
I wanted to make this one point. I served with the military for a short period right after out of high school, and I took the oath. You know, I took the oath to defend my country and the Constitution. And I'm just beginning to see what that oath was all about.
Yeah, well,
you know, it's the type of thing where we are blessed as a country. We were given self-governance. People have the responsibility to govern themselves, and not have the government telling you, okay, we need you to take the first step out of bed to go to work in the morning, you know? It's like you have the responsibility to do that, and it carries on through the rest of our lives. We were given the ability to make our own decisions about how we want to be, and it seems like people are just throwing it away. I don't know. I don't think they understand what it is.
I think you're right. Let's let David respond.
Chris, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for serving our country and for taking care of not only yourself but the rest of us, so that we can sleep well at night and know that the freedoms that we still have we can enjoy. You are correct that the column that I write is based on the principle that the very first thing a citizen should do is at least take care of themselves and not burden the rest of society. And that seems to be a rare case this way. It's hard to make an argument against it, and yet most people don't do what's necessary to take care of themselves. They allow sort of this fallback position and say, well, gosh, someone should give me money to go to college. Someone should give me money in my retirement. Someone should give me. And if you have two different people and one has lived high on the hog and the other one has saved more of their money, we tend to reward the first one by giving them things because they ran out of money. And we tend to penalize the second one by taxing the amount that they've saved. Even if both of them have the same salary, the second one can be a millionaire because they live frugally, and the first one can have nothing because they live high on the hog.
And Chris, thank you so much for the call. And it just reminds me of all these people who are getting their mortgages bailed out by your and my tax dollars because they were not responsible. They bought too much house. There may be a couple of instances where somebody was deceived, but that's something for the courts, not for the general public. And here we are getting taxed in order that other people can stay in the homes that they were not frugal about in the first place. David Murata, it was a fast hour. We covered about 20% of the material, but that's okay. It's how it goes sometimes. Visit David Murata online at emurata.com. And David, we look forward to your next appearance here on The Shilling Show.
Thank you so much.